presidential debate time. You have 30 seconds. What is your hot take?
Historic moment. A cop killed a white man. I'm sorry, my time is up.
So, for some reason, Portland cement has been in the news lately.
Yeah. Apparently, you can just put quick drying cement in anything that you want to. You can throw it in your vegan milkshakes, according to some sources. Just throw vegan milkshake in there and throw it at a cop. I also have heard that Acme stocks have just gone through the roof recently. You know, people are painting train openings on the side of mountains and lots of impromptu catapult. Yeah, you know, watch out, fascists.
So obviously, Portland Police Department has once again shown how ready and willing they are to collaborate with fascists in the greater Portland area. They essentially amplified completely unsourced made-up claims by Joey Gibson. They put out a tweet saying that they had received reports of Antifa protesters putting quick-drying cement into the milkshakes that were being thrown at various fascist figures and sympathizers. Of course, quick-drying cement put into a milkshake is completely neutralized and completely harmless. Apparently, when this tweet came out, the fascists tried to claim that the cement would turn the milkshakes into bricks somehow. Obviously, that was completely disproven the first time one was thrown.
Yeah.
And then they switched the narrative to, oh, it's going to cause chemical burns, which, for starters, quick-drying cement doesn't do that unless you leave it on your skin for a long period of time. And even that mild caustic effect is completely counteracted by the acids in the milkshake in the form of sugar and the various fruit juices. So that was complete bullshit. Why did Portland PD promote a complete bullshit story with no verification, no evidence? Like, the only evidence that they provided was an email that had been sent to them anonymously after their tweet. An email that was obviously false, literally saying, guess what, piggies? We're making milkshakes with vegan milkshake mix, soy milk, and fucking quick-drying cement.
It is the most obvious, like, COINTELPRO style, like...
It was probably written, like, by a cop.
Yeah, like, it is the most obvious cop-authored, like, statement I've heard in a while. Like, just, hey, we've been burning the American flag and flipping off cop cars and, you know, saying that Ronald Reagan wasn't a very nice guy over the weekend. Haha, that's Antifa. Like, oh my god. Like, they're bad and they're dumb and they're fascist collaborators, if not outright fascists. And fuck PPD. They can go fuck themselves.
Yeah, and I think that's been pretty well established, but the story did get out into the news media, especially on conservative blogs, as usual, and essentially that entire series of street fights became an attempt to create a large, like, victim narrative, and the three main prongs of that narrative were cement milkshakes, Andy Ngo getting a brain bleed from being punched, and a picture of a, quote, elderly gentleman walking out of the rally with blood pouring down his face. So yeah. I'll answer the elderly gentleman real quick. The fascists immediately started promoting video of various fights in the aftermath of this rally and this clash between Antifa and Patriot Prayer. Some of the footage that they put out was stuff from 2017 and 2018, and some of it was stuff where they showed fights where a fascist had waded into the black block to try to get some hits in and then showed them getting their ass beat and claimed, oh no, Antifa is attacking people. So in this case, this old guy with a fedora waded into the middle of the black block with an expanding baton, hit someone with it in the back of the head, got pepper sprayed, walked through the pepper spray swinging his baton, and finally two of the black block members stepped in and hit him in the thigh and in the back of the head with their own batons, and he fell back crying, covered in blood. Of course, and this is not some random gentleman. This guy had a Totenkopf ring. He had prison tattoos. This is a hardcore fucking white supremacist who came ready to fight, ready to cause trouble. And when he got his ass beat, they took a picture of him covered in blood and posted up claiming that he was an innocent person who was attacked randomly.
Yeah.
Fuck off with that bullshit.
Yeah.
But because the fascists are able to amplify their opinions so quickly because they have these blogs and these shitty conservative news sites who are willing to just report whatever they say without any checking and amplify it. That's a big part of the narrative that came out of this series of riots.
Yeah, it's amazing how far they'll go to make things fit that narrative. They'll really just grasp at anything, any fucking straws that they can find, you know? Like, I believe the fedora marks him as a high-level gamer, you know?
I'm sure he's had a few heated gamer moments.
Yeah, he was almost certainly at Ground Zero during the Gamergate crisis.
Assuming he wasn't in jail with his neo-Nazi buddies.
Yeah. So, fuck that guy. Really, really generously stretching the limits of the term journalist to call that Ngo guy.
Yeah, he writes for the conservative blog site Quillette, which I don't think employs anyone with a journalism degree, to my knowledge. They might have a single editor on staff. But most of the people who do it are just right-wing personalities, people who have a social media following who portray themselves as journalists. And Andy Ngo is literally a provocateur. He helped organize the Cider Riot attack when Patriot Prayer stepped up on a bunch of anti-fascists outside a bar and started throwing rocks at them, started throwing punches. And that whole series of fights where one of the Patriot Prayer members hit an Antifa woman in the back of the neck and broke one of her vertebrae. And then Andy Ngo took the footage that he took of that attack, put it online on Twitter with her name and her employer, and essentially doxed her after she was viciously attacked and received a major injury. Furthermore, when that woman then tried to create a GoFundMe to raise money for that, he sicked his conservative followers on her, calling her a grifter, saying that she was a liar, demanding to see her medical records, and basically forced her to shut the GoFundMe down after she'd only raised $3,000. Meanwhile, wow. Andy Ngo gets a fucking black eye and a cut cheek after he gets punched a couple times for shoving his camera in people's faces. Then he goes out and claims that he has a brain bleed, raises $160,000 in a couple of days on GoFundMe, and then starts showing up on conservative news shows, talk shows, fucking national television the next day. If you have a brain bleed, you're not going to be on the fucking news the next day. You're going to be kept in the hospital.
Yeah.
By brain bleed, he probably had a minor concussion.
Yeah.
And so he's literally lying, not showing his own medical records. Raising a bunch of money off of GoFundMe after attacking an Antifa woman who he filmed attacking in an attack that he organized. This guy's not a journalist. He's a propagandist.
Yeah. Like I said, you know, really stretching the limits of the term journalist. But it makes it fit the narrative that, oh shit, Antifa's attacking journalists. They're the real fascists.
Yeah, and I guess that's sort of the big question that always hovers over Antifa is the damage that they do to fascist organizing on the ground worth the negative media coverage that they generate for the left? And I'm not going to make a blanket statement one way or the other. I think sometimes Antifa comes out on top. They do more damage than they take. And other times the fascists come out on top. And this time I think they came out on top in the court of public opinion.
Yeah. Solidarity with everyone who bashes the fash, you know,
that's
tough work, and it's seriously got to be done. The only way that a fascist tide like this can get crushed is with overwhelming force, and that's exactly what we saw that other day in DC, where the, you know, of course with their police escort, I mean, that kind of goes without saying, but I believe it was a Proud Boy demonstration in DC, and it was seriously crazy outnumbered by the anti-fascist organizers out there, so good on y'all.
Oh, definitely. That was a good showing. And even though the DC police were somewhat biased, there was one incident where a fascist punched an Antifa protester and the cops arrested the Antifa protester. But aside from that, I think the anti-fascists were able to pretty much hold it down, not take too much bait, and basically disrupt them and prevent them from getting their message out beyond their core group. Mm-hmm. And basically stop them from marching through the streets fairly effectively, but obviously with cooperation from the cops, there's only so much you can do.
There's only so much you can do. They probably had a good eye for the incredibly nuanced and measured approach of COINTELPRO members of the Antifa organizing. You know, maybe someone was like, hey, anyone want to trade in some illegal arms or transfer ammunition from one party to another within the confines of Washington, D.C. It really requires a master class in, in espionage.
Definitely. I do want to give a shout out, though, to the drag queens who showed up to that event and managed to successfully shut down a couple of provocateurs and MAGA hats who tried to wander into the back of the Antifa group to start shit.
Oh, damn. I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, apparently a group of drag queens shut them down pretty hard. I don't know if any punches were thrown. I haven't seen video of it, but apparently they managed to eject them from the crowd.
Fuck yeah. Goddamn.
But, you know, all this street violence is one thing. Rather more concerning is when people start taking it out of the context of protest and start bringing it home, which is what happened in Philadelphia. A group of Proud Boys doxed an anti-fascist organizer. Notably, not an Antifa organizer. She was not involved in street actions or direct actions against Nazis. She was engaged more on the doxing ends of things, on the spreading and sharing information sort of, you know, anti-fascist organizing.
Yeah, which is damn good work. Props to anyone who does that.
It's vital.
Yeah, you gotta shut them down before they even show up.
In this case, though, they essentially counter-doxed her and showed up to her apartment, as well as to the apartments of several other activists in the Philly area. Between 9 and 12 Proud Boys, some of them open carrying rifles, showed up to their apartment doors, knocked, and asked their neighbors if they'd seen them. Fortunately, the organizer who reported on this was not home when it happened. However, the Proud Boys left stickers on her door and on street poles near her property to mark that they had been there. Apparently, they had a camera which recorded the Proud Boys coming up to the door shouting threats. That footage has been handed to the Philly Police Department. However, the Philly Police Department originally didn't want to do anything about it until it went viral on social media.
What? No way. That's so surprising.
Yeah, who would have figured that the police department that attacked the move house with 50 caliber machine guns and a bomb, who would have thought that they might have some reluctance to prosecute fascist gangs?
Yeah, they're way too busy leveling a fucking block to bother. Yeah. Fuck Philly PD. Police departments will always, we've covered this so much on this show, they're always just reluctant to do anything about fascists. It makes me really curious about how in God's name all that anti-fascist FBI organizing happened in the 80s, you know, to shut down various rando militias and stuff like that. Like, it's bizarre to even think about.
Well, back then, they cared more about guns and illegal automatic weapons. You know, it wasn't so much about their political beliefs or organizing so much as the particular illegal things they were doing to fund their operations.
Oh, actually, I do know the answer to some of this, at least. It's ever since the 80s, there was a concerted efforts on a ton of fascist organizers to infiltrate police departments and become members and stuff, and now that shit is pretty deep-seated, and you can see the effects of it.
Absolutely. Like, these attitudes and these sort of political leanings were already present in police forces at that time. Having the explicit fascists join police departments and normalize those political beliefs and, you know, validate them and basically say, oh, no, don't listen to the liberal reformers. It's okay to be mega racist against black people. It's okay to look down on liberals or people that you disagree with politically and enact political violence against them. Oh, that's fine. You know, don't listen to this liberal chief who disagrees with me. Here, support me and maybe I'll become the chief and then we can do whatever we want. Wouldn't that be nice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it directly translates to the kind of executive police power that police departments enjoy right now, where they can kind of kill with impunity, they can racially profile with impunity. I mean, the public calls them out on it. This has been true for a while. You can film an incident and say, look, this is clearly what the video shows. The body cam footage can clearly show, oh wow, this officer absolutely abused his power. Oh wow, that officer straight up murdered that guy. And they so rarely get prosecuted that clearly this fascist organizing has had an effect on police power in this country and on police attitudes, which is pretty scary.
So obviously there's a lot of stuff that the armed left needs to do and a lot of ways that we need to develop. Some of these were mentioned in an article recently on The New Republic, an article written by Corey Pine, who's sympathetic to the SRA and other organizations in this space. The article itself was mostly just going over the existence of these groups and what our missions are. But in addition to that, Corey provided a number of quotes from his interviews with various figures on the armed left. Some of these comments made it into the article, some of them he posted in the Twitter thread following it. So I'm just going to read a couple of these quotes with recommendations on what the SRA should be doing, and then I think we'll comment on those.
Yeah.
So this is from Corey Pine in the Twitter thread after the article. Adrian Bonenberger, the veteran and SRA member, remains adamant that these threats must not be dismissed and demand an appropriate response. After all, the U.S. is not exceptional. Political power depends on the credible threat of violence, he said. That's how politics actually works. I saw it. I did it at the town level in Afghanistan. It's not being cynical to say that's absolutely how things work. He suggests leftists and liberals who are concerned with maintaining a fascist deterrent should join the U.S. military and focus on infantry, pilot, and special operations combat training. Is there any hope of organizing a leftist militia? No, it would be a slaughter, he said. In the best case scenario, we're 2 years into a 10-year process, and 8 years from now we could maybe be competitive. But from what I've seen, we're actually 2 years into a 20-year process. So Adrian Bonenberger is a good guy. I think I've been on his podcast in the past, I think late last year or early in the spring. So I think there's two main parts to that comment, which would be the recommendation that people interested in armed self-defense and community defense organizing should go into the U.S. military for training, and also his comments on the time frame. So what are your thoughts, Austin?
I'd say no is my initial thought, just because of the material harm that could potentially go into a stint in the military. You know, there is demonstrable potential imperialism and being privy to imperialism, not to mention the incompatibility with horizontal structuring that leftists typically engage in, where the military is very hierarchical and there is a natural distrust of active members of the military in leftist spaces.
Well, I don't want any veterans to feel like they're untrusted in leftist circles.
Veterans are a totally different ball game, in my opinion.
Because it's the thing, like I think that we should absolutely encourage veterans to move towards leftist politics. I don't think they should be castigated for being tools of imperialism or anything, because a lot of times, you know, people go in because they feel like they have to, because they feel like it's their best economic opportunity, or some people go in and they have bad political beliefs. A lot of people, through their experiences in the military, realize, oh shit, all of that was wrong. I shouldn't be participating in that. And then they get out of the military. And I think that those people should be welcomed with open arms.
Absolutely, you know, agreed.
As much as possible. On the other hand, taking existing leftists and asking them to join the military is a bit of a different story, because then you're, for one, you're taking those people out of civilian life where they could engage in active organizing in their community. They could organize like in labor unions, they could organize in tenants unions, they could organize anti-fascist actions. By going into the military, you are locked into the military for 4 years or 6 years or however long your term is. You are locked into it and you cannot leave. And you go where the military tells you to go and you do what the military tells you to do. And having people go into the military is basically removing them from our organizing. And yeah, people get really valuable training while they're in the military, all kinds of training, not just with firearms, but like learning how to organize things. That's all really useful. But you get that training in your first 1 or 2 years in the military, and then you're on deployment and you're serving American military interests overseas, or you're working on some base and you can't interact with the larger left movement. It seems like there are easier ways to get that training. It seems to me like it's more valuable for existing veterans to come to the left and share their skills with others and spread that knowledge around. It seems like that would be more useful than sending people into the military and then hoping they come back out with their politics intact and then sharing that information. It seems like joining the military is not the correct course.
Yeah, the training is definitely valuable. We absolutely appreciate the veterans that we do have in the SRA. Thank you for coming to our organization. But yeah, sending active leftists into the military is not something that I can endorse at all.
On the other hand, I do think Adrian has a point with regards to the time frame that we're 2 years into a 10 or 20 year process. I don't think it's fair to say that the armed left has only been organizing for 2 years, because Redneck Revolt has been around for longer than that. They've been around since the late 2000s. There's been other groups doing this sort of work. There are leftist militias out in Appalachia and parts of the Pacific Northwest. They've been doing this work. The issue is it's been small, it's been local, it's been essentially people who already have that knowledge. And so in trying to expand leftist gun culture and trying to expand leftist armed organizing, I think that, yeah, we are maybe like 2 years into a process that really takes much longer. And honestly, that's one of the things I worry about the most, is that the SRA is barely more than a year old. Our goal is to develop the left to the point where we have leftist owned and leftist friendly gun ranges and leftist friendly gun stores and gunsmiths, where we have leftist firearms instructors who can share this information, where we have people who have highly developed skills, who have good equipment, who are willing to engage in community defense praxis if it's needed. And right now, we are at the beginning of that process. We have a small pool of instructors. We have a small pool of people who are very competent. And developing the infrastructure and getting people together to share those skills takes time. And I think it will take 10 years for the SRA to reach the point where I think that we've established a broad pool of people. And so it's really a question of, if are things going to fall apart in less than 10 years before we're ready? And honestly, that's what keeps me up at night. But I think it still needs to be done. I think even if we don't reach the level of development that there needs to be, I still think that the organizing we're doing is valuable. It's just a matter of, we're running against the clock. I think that it would have been really good if SRA had been established 10 years ago to do what it's doing today. Yeah. But I think if it was made 10 years ago, it wouldn't have been successful.
Yeah, no, I completely agree, because the last few years have demonstrated the necessity of leftist organizing for a lot of people. I mean, I wasn't even a leftist before a few years ago. I think that seeing the material effects of fascism on the public level, I think that that is the necessary part of radicalizing and of demonstrating to more public spaces that, you know, hey, wouldn't it be nice if there was an alternative to bullshit liberalism and the way it concedes to fascism?
Yeah, and I'll have some comments about Pelosi in a few moments, but first, first I want to read a couple of other quotes. So in addition to Adrian Bonenberger, Corey Pine also interviewed a guy named Belden, who was formerly a Kurdish militia volunteer, a volunteer with the Syrian Defense Forces in Rojava. He responded to Bonenberger's advice by saying, quote, "I don't think joining the military for the purpose of military training is a good idea. Who are you training on, Iraqi citizens? If you want a boot camp type thing, you can go to a private course and you don't have to join the army." Moreover, he said, "Proper people's armies demand novel command structures. I'm not sure being in a traditional military will prepare you. Don't mistake that for me saying you shouldn't train for stuff." Quote, "Before people train themselves to be snipers or whatever, they should learn discipline and how to work as a group with other people." End quote. "Labor power is an advantage the right can never properly wield," Belden paraphrases Lenin in arguing that strikes are practice for revolution. Quote, "They teach you how to work as a group. They teach you how to be disciplined. They teach you how to think tactically, and they teach you how to fight. Way more than going to the range and shooting a couple of bullseyes." End quote. This year, Belden helped lead a successful union drive at a craft brewery in San Francisco. Quote, "If people want to prepare for revolution, they should become labor organizers." Yeah. I think that all of that is pretty much spot on.
Yeah, that is 100% exactly what I believe in regard to that, to the previous statement.
Yeah, I think I've said it before and I'll say it again. The armed left is a necessary but insufficient component of the organizing that we need to be doing right now. as socialists, as anarchists, as communists, as progressives. I think that it's important to lay the groundwork and build the infrastructure and to get people comfortable with and have a basic level of familiarity with firearms. But that should be a secondary activity to our primary leftist goals of establishing unions, you know, establishing radical unions, creating tenant unions, creating collectives and co-ops, creating parties if that's what you're into, and going out and providing mutual aid and doing direct action when needed and engaging in anti-fascist organizing. Like, we need to think bigger than a single type of praxis. This needs to be a diversity of tactics, a diversity of strategies for moving forward and building a mass movement. A mass movement has to have many fronts, and the armed left is a single front within that larger movement. I think that it's worth going to the range and shooting a few bullseyes and getting comfortable with a gun, but that should be supplementary to your primary organizing goals, unless because of your particular skill set and your particular interests and your particular material conditions, if you think that learning to shoot and becoming an instructor, becoming an SRA chapter organizer, doing that sort of organizing, if that's what calls to you, if that's what you think you're good at, then you should do that. Not everyone is capable of organizing a union. Not everybody works in a industry that is conducive to union organizing. You need to look at your present situation and what you are capable of doing and what you're willing to do, and then go do that. So, obviously, I think that labor organizing is of the utmost importance, and I think that learning about guns is also of the utmost importance. But I think that in terms of advancing leftist goals, although I am a leader of the SRA and I think that this is important, I think it's a secondary thing that we need to be working on within the broader movement.
Yeah, 100%. It's a supporting move as opposed to the tip of the spear, which is 100% labor organizing. We all as leftists have to work on organizing our labor spaces and organizing labor in general to further our goals and to actually change society for the better.
Absolutely. But there's also been a lot of talk lately of people wondering what they can do in terms of helping with the concentration camps at the border, which is an extremely difficult problem to deal with.
Yeah, what a fucking sickening time in our country. Seriously, where we have concentration camps and wandering armed fascist militias.
Yeah, it's difficult to know what to do. Obviously, I don't think that any sort of violent direct action is really going to be helpful or useful in this situation. I think that there's a mix of people who are extremely agitated by this and want to do something, and also provocateurs trying to egg people into doing illegal actions. Don't do anything stupid with regards to detention centers. What needs to happen now is there needs to be a mass change in public perception, and there needs to be mutual aid when possible to prevent people from ending up in these camps and, you know, contributing to their legal defense. Because right now, we essentially have an entire federal agency dedicated to jailing children and to jailing people who have committed a misdemeanor offense in crossing the border.
Yeah, when seeking asylum is an entirely legal thing to do, and all of them are asylum seekers.
Absolutely.
I do 100% think that good work can be done as far as public pressure. Various anti-fascist organizers have released names and workplaces, whatever, of ICE members, and I think that we've seen good effects of people not being able to dine in peace, not being able to leave their house in peace. I'm not talking showing up like dipshit Proud Boys in the middle of the night. I'm talking about shouting people down constantly.
Noise demos,
yes, like just finding ways to disrupt, body block, prevent people from accessing roadways. There are so many things that we can do that don't involve guns to make being a tool of a fascist regime extremely unpleasant.
Late last year in Portland again, anti-fascist activists essentially created a camp blocking the entrance to the ICE facility's parking lot, preventing employees from getting to their job. And they were able to not completely shut down, but severely limit the activity of that ICE office for a period of a couple of weeks before the police managed to shove them out of the way. I think that that sort of thing is needed at every concentration camp in this country. We need nonviolent resistance. We need people blocking the entrances to these buildings. We need people doing noise demos. We need people confronting employees on their way into work. And like, conservatives are going to cry about that. But isn't that exactly the same type of shit they've been doing to abortion clinics for decades? Those are tactics that they picked up from radical leftist actions in the anti-war movement. We need to continue using those actions ourselves and going out and just making it hell for the employees there. Just making yourself a pain in the ass, forcing these people to work around you, putting your bodies in the way. You know, we've talked about this before, but in a lot of ways, putting your body on the line in a completely nonviolent way can be one of the most effective organizing tools we have.
100%.
If we can stop these concentration camp workers from getting to their jobs or slow them down, then I think we can do a lot to make that job uncomfortable for these people and encourage more of them to quit. Now, obviously, the possibility is that this might be responded to with elevations of violence from the police. Obviously, the police usually respond with handcuffs, pepper spray, shoving and beating people with truncheons. It's obviously any sort of nonviolent protest like that, you have to go into it with the knowledge the police are going to use violence against you.
Right. But I think that that's absolutely a risk that we have to take. And as leftists and as people who are explicitly anti-fascist, as people who refuse to let our country descend into a fascist totalitarian state any more than it already has, in order to actually put our words into action, I think that we owe it to the people who are being put in concentration camps. It's like, I saw a post fairly recently that said, if you ever wondered what you'd do during slavery, what you'd do during the Holocaust, you know, whatever, if you ever wondered what you would do during those times, you're doing it right now. And I think that as leftists, we need to take things like that really seriously. We need to think about the type of privileges we have to still roam the country freely, you know, and we need to think about what we can do with that power, what we can do with the power of our labor, what we can do with the power of our bodies. With enough public pressure, this will go one way or another. If the cops use excessive force, then boom, the public perception is even worse against concentration camps. If they use a kind of minimal amount of force, then we can do it again and again and again until it changes. We have numbers on our side.
Absolutely. So that's my recommendation of what should be done about the camps at this point in time.
Yeah, find some local organizers, find organizations that can warn people when ICE is in the neighborhood, organize with whoever is around locally, and get that public power strong.
Exactly. Certainly don't do what Pelosi did and give the Trump administration $4 billion with a handshake agreement to notify them of any children that die.
Oh my God. Ugh, I hate her. Oh, I hate her. Go away.
Forget Schumer, who signed off on the deal in the first place.
Well, of course.
So, again, liberalism is useless. Electoralism is useless. Put your body on the line. The electoral process and people like the Democratic Party are the official rubber stamp on the societal progress that is made by left-wing activists.
Mm-hmm.
We make the progress, they come in at the end to sign it into law, and they take the credit.
Yep. Just like the government shutdown that was ended with the traffic controller strike.
Exactly. And, you know, it sucks that the liberals will always take the credit in the public media because they more or less control the public mass media. But ultimately, it's about the material effects that we can have as people, and the material effects that we can have are done through mass movement organizing, through nonviolent protest, and through armed and unarmed community defense.
Yeah, it's exactly like this situation in Portland.
Yeah, with the where the GOP walked out on a climate bill and holed up with some militias in Idaho.
Yeah, well, that's the funny thing. At least some of the news outlets are reporting that they refused the help and the security of the right-wing militias and stuff, which, you know, I don't know if I buy that. There was that one, I believe it was Brian someone, but he was like, oh, you better send veteran officers and come heavily armed, because I'm not going to be made to attend my own fucking job.
He said you should send bachelors and come heavily armed.
That's what it was.
So straight up implying that he was willing to kill people.
Yeah.
So I think there was just one GOP official who, like, explicitly holed up with the fascist militia. And I think a couple other people that made some ambiguous comments. And then the others just went into hiding in Idaho.
Yeah, some of them were spotted in my hometown.
Yeah.
Shout out Boise. But, you know, fuck you.
And obviously the Idaho police weren't going to help because the Idaho police are explicitly fascists.
Yeah.
Like, for anyone who doesn't know, the mountainous parts of northern Idaho were settled by neo-Nazis and other sorts of types preparing for another American Civil War back in the 80s and 90s, you know, in the wake of the whole Waco incident. A whole bunch of neo-Nazis and fascist militias moved up into the hills in North Idaho, and guess what, 30-40 years on, those people are in law enforcement. A lot of them, they've become sheriffs, they've become deputies, they've become city police in Boise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people like to think, look at these things in isolation, but you have a mass migration of fascists to a region, those fascists are going to infiltrate and become a part of the civic organization of that region. And that's what happened to Idaho, and that's what's happened to Eastern Washington and Eastern Oregon, who are also a part of that fascist wave.
Yeah.
Or the scum on that fascist wave.
Yeah. Boise's where my heart is, but man, we got we learned a long time ago to never trust BPD. The best part, just to drive this point home of how ineffectual and flailing and pathetic legislation actually is, a few of the GOP members were escorted back, they came back, the vote happened, and the Democrats voted to send it back to committee. They fucking killed the bill that was years in the making.
Mm-hmm.
I think that perfectly, they were like, no, you have to be here so we can vote this down. It perfectly epitomizes how pathetic and how ineffectual and undemocratic any part of even state government can be. It tells you down to your bones how broken this system is and why we advocate so explicitly not for electoralism. We'll throw in some snide remarks about the debates or whatever.
It's not unimportant.
It's not unimportant, but it's the effectiveness of electoralism absolutely pales in comparison to actual leftist organizing, to strikes, to body blocking, noise demos, whatever else you're going to do to actually affect change in the world. Do that, and do the electoralism when you're bored in your spare time, when a vote comes up.
If you have the time and you have the energy and you are informed on local and state and national politics, you know, might as well go out and vote. But if you're not plugged into that at all, there are other more important forms of organizing that you can do. Electoralism should be the last thing on your list.
Yeah.
I'm not saying never do it. I think boycotting votes is, for reasons of principle, is just not helpful. But if you have the ability and you have the time, just go out and vote in whatever elections you're comfortable voting in, but then put the rest of your energy into more useful things.
Yeah. Any kind of change that is better for the people is going to come from them. It is never going to come from the top down.
The actions that we take as activists define what is possible in the electoral realm. Mm. So if we engage in left-wing activism, we are expanding the options for left-wing electoralism down the road and making those victories in those spaces more likely, as long as we don't have massive media failures and communications failures. But again, direct action, mutual aid, community self-defense, labor organizing, tenants union organizing, co-ops, everything that we shout about every episode, going and standing in solidarity with people of color and getting between them and the cops, if you're a white person, using your privilege and using your body to protect other activists and other organizers, that's really important work that everyone needs to be doing.
Absolutely.
If you can, if you're able.
Yeah, so fuck Pelosi, fuck her lib service.
Shout out to AOC, though. I think a lot of people diss on her just because they get that sort of edgy, lefter-than-thou sort of vibe and want to condemn her as a sock dumb or whatever. Like, she's not perfect, obviously. I wish she'd do more to condemn Israel and other sorts of foreign policy issues where the U.S. is being imperialist. I wish she was better in those fields. But as far as getting out the message on communicating just how evil Republicans are and communicating just how bad the concentration camp situation is, that's Praxis, and she's doing a good job.
Yeah, I totally agree. Seeing AOC elected and be an actual representative of a lot of the public's views is something that was definitely made possible because of leftist organizing and because of the shift in public perception about people who probably a little bit incorrectly are calling themselves democratic socialists, but good enough for now.
Absolutely. Well, any other topics we want to hit? Do you have any firearms questions?
So I was doing a bit of looking and found myself pretty interested in 357/38 caliber lever action rifles. Do you think that would be a good practical rifle for home defense or whatever else?
So as far as it being a practical rifle, it certainly wouldn't be my first choice. 357 lever actions are extremely fun. They're very cool. The lever action system is fun to operate. It's very mechanically satisfying. And there's, as far as like being an economical, recreational, and practice shooting firearm, being able to shoot cheap 38 wad cutter ammunition and being able to put like 15 rounds in a tube magazine, that's pretty appealing as a recreational firearm. But for home defense, it wouldn't be my first choice. A lever action rifle is going to have the same sorts of problems that any pistol or pistol caliber carbine would have, which is that unlike a small light projectile, like from an AR-15, which might break up when going through drywall, those pistol rounds will tend to travel straight through and keep going and have a higher likelihood of passing through multiple walls and injuring someone on the other side of them or damaging someone's, you know, property, like their vehicle or whatever. And that's exacerbated if you're shooting like a 357 round out of a rifle length barrel. That's a very heavy projectile going fast enough to have a lot of kinetic energy, but not fast enough to break up on impact. So that would be my sort of concern there. Overpenetration is an issue. You could maybe make an argument for, like, again, 38 wad cutters as defensive rounds have some pros and cons to them. Some people, you know, say that they're a pretty good option. But again, it's not really my first choice for a home defense sort of scenario. An AR-15 is honestly the best option. In certain applications, if you're in a region where AR-15s are heavily restricted, you could maybe make an argument for a shotgun with low recoil buckshot. You could maybe make an argument for a pistol caliber carbine, like a semi-automatic carbine. But a lever action, you know, even though they're very fun, they do have a higher chance of malfunctioning than your typical blowback operated semi-auto pistol caliber carbine. I'm not saying it doesn't have any utility, but I think it's more of a fun range gun than something that's going to have a practical application for home defense. Now, for hunting, you know, if you want a hunting rifle, if you're in an area that's heavily forested where you might be hunting deer or similar animals, 357 is a pretty decent deer hunting round, and a lever action rifle does a perfectly fine job in those sorts of environments. So for a hunting rifle, it's certainly an option if you want something a little more interesting than a bolt action rifle. But beyond that, I don't think they have too much practical use.
Fine.
They are cool. They are cool.
They are so cool.
But they're not really practical. But on the other hand, if you want to get out to the range and practice more, you're not going to shoot a gun that isn't fun to shoot. So if you have your practical weapons that have a practical application but maybe aren't as interesting, having an interesting weapon that's fun to shoot, like a lever action, like something else that's unique or interesting, if it'll get you out to the range to practice more, then fine. I think that's a perfectly valid reason to own a gun if you can afford it. On the other hand, maybe you could put that money to better use, helping out vulnerable comrades, donating to worthwhile causes. Ultimately, the decision is up to you. But as far as practical application, no. But they are fun guns to shoot. I can't deny picking up a 357 lever action always puts a bit of a smile on my face. You know, even if it's not the most useful thing.
Yeah, we discussed this recently, but what are your thoughts on a 22 pistol or whatever being the go-to home defense thing, because it won't deafen you, you can shoot it multiple times, and all that stuff.
So yeah, I think a 22 caliber pistol has more application for home defense than a lot of people give it credit for. Realistically, for home defense, I would rather have a 22 revolver than a 9mm pistol. The 22 is going to overpenetrate less, it's going to deafen you less, it's going to blind you less, it's going to have less recoil, it's going to be more controllable. You know, having an AR-15, which is what I normally recommend for home defense, like, it's going to deafen you, it's going to blind you, but it's also one or two shots and your target will no longer be a threat to you. With a 22 caliber pistol, you don't have that guarantee that someone will be stopped quickly, because 22 is a less effective round, but you can get off more shots without losing orientation in your home, without dulling your senses. And even if it's not as powerful or as lethal of a cartridge, if someone gets shot two or three times with the 22, in most cases they're going to run the fuck away, or else they're just going to fall down to the ground from shock, from the psychological stop of, oh my god, I've been shot. What do people do when they're shot? Oh, they fall to the ground. I guess I'll do that. It's a sort of a subconscious reaction people have, even if it's they've been shot in a way that's non-lethal. So I think a 22 revolver has application for home defense more so than a 9mm pistol would. But I would not recommend a semi-automatic pistol in 22 caliber, because those tend to have reliability issues. They can be really picky about what ammo you load them with. A revolver is going to be more mechanically reliable, as long as it's not old and worn out. If it's a revolver that you've taken out and taken to the range and you've made sure it doesn't have any manufacturing defects, the 22 revolver is going to be more reliable than the 22 caliber pistol, like semi-auto. So I would recommend that. But again, I think the king of home defense is going to be the AR-15 still.
Gotcha.
All right. Insert transition to music here. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to have an interview with a couple of organizers from the SRA San Francisco Bay chapter. They've put together some pretty good events the last few weeks, and we'd like to hear from them about what they've accomplished. In the meantime, we've got some music from ambient artist Friendly Froggy. You can find a link to more of her music down in the show notes. This track is called Reunion. Enjoy! Welcome back. Today we have an interview with a couple of SRA organizers from the San Francisco Bay chapter. They've put together a couple of really impressive events lately. They've been doing some really great work. So we'd like to hear from them about what advice they have for chapter organizers and how to put together really good events, especially at events like Pride Parades. So welcome to the show, Rob and Mango.
I'm Rob. I'm the organizer for the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the SRA.
And it's good to be here. I'm Mango. I'm the design director of the SRA and a member of the SF Bay Area chapter.
Awesome. Well, it's great to have you on. So the main thing that you did recently was the SRA booth at the San Francisco Pride Parade. Can you tell us a bit about that action? How did you get started with a project like that?
So one of our members has a few other connections with other organizations that were taking part in SF Pride. So they had the idea of having us included as well. So we figured that we should take a shot and apply for a spot during Pride. We're like fully aware that quite a few other SRA chapters weren't quite as lucky as we were as securing a spot in their local Prides. We are fairly lucky to be in the Bay Area with our liberal socialist politics over here. But we were able to secure a spot, and as soon as that happened, the spreadsheets were made, all the meetings were set, and it was quite a bumpy ride to get there.
It sounds like. So what was the process? Not necessarily just like the bureaucratic stuff, but how did you organize it and bring it all together? I noticed you had like a really professional looking booth. I was pretty impressed by that.
You can thank all the party supplies I got for the decorations.
Yeah, we're really lucky to have Mango with all their design expertise, and they really kicked it into high gear with their connections and just their work. We shopped around for local printers, which was a lot of fun, supporting some of these local businesses. But I mean, the way we kind of started was just attending some of the meetings. A member suggested it, knew about it ahead of time, heard about the planning ahead of time, attended the first meeting, brought back all the paperwork, all the stuff we needed to sign, and then it was just kind of divvied up. There's many hands in our chapter that helped out with the work, and some folks helped out, like Mango, with getting print materials, as well as banners done up, and the design work. Others helped out with acquiring t-shirt vendors and printers. The rest of us brought supplies, whether it be water and snacks or pop-out tents. We were lucky enough that we had enough time ahead of time to plan out and really think hard about what we needed to have there to show our best face. And I'd say about 2 months of meetings went into the planning.
Well, it looks like it all paid off. From what I understand, the booth was a big hit. And even though you were across the aisle from the San Francisco Sheriff's Department, it sounds like everything went really smoothly. And I think we got at least a couple of members signed up who mentioned seeing you at Pride as the inspiration for them joining.
Oh, that makes me really happy. We did get a really positive reaction to our booth. Of course, there were quite a few people who were heckling us a bit, whether it be about the socialist part, whether it be about the rifle part. But all in all, when people had the time to talk to us about who we really were, like quite a few people practically did a total 180 about what their original perception of us was, and they sounded all really super on board, and it's really making me happy that it ended up getting us some members.
Yeah, something that I tend to talk about a lot when it comes to interacting with the public and recruiting purposes, meeting new people, is I really want to remind our members to think about how we want our chapters to look, the diversity that we want to see in our chapters. And as Mango said, you know, there were people that came up to us who were very antagonistic, but luckily we didn't want to focus on engaging them beyond that, those brief interactions. We instead chose to spend our time talking to people who could benefit from becoming part of our community. We didn't want to drag people into this who are going to replicate any kind of toxic cultures within our organization. We weren't really focused on white, hetero, cis men, because one of the things that we think about is we don't want to see that as becoming the dominating factor in leadership for our chapter. And we still want to keep a diverse group of people engaging with a horizontal leadership.
Absolutely. A big part of this event was also promoting your fundraising drive for handing out respirators to the homeless and other vulnerable people in case of wildfires in California. So can you tell us a little bit about that plan and how much money you've raised so far?
I can definitely talk about that. So as most of us probably remember, last year's fires were quite devastating, especially up here in the Bay Area, Northern California in general. And another very familiar factor about the Bay Area is that we have a growing homeless, shelterless population, a very vulnerable population considering the mass migration and like tech employees and displacement and all of that. So when natural disasters hit, those are the folks that are going to be hit the hardest. And after what happened last year, we decided that they needed to be focused on more this year, whether or not the fires are as bad. So when we had our booth set up, one of our main reasons of having the booth was to fundraise for this project. And we had some stickers printed out. Shout out to Off Color Decals. Visit their Etsy. So they sent us a bunch of stickers that we were able to sell. We also had some buttons that drew a bunch of people in. Since it's Pride and people get free things, people would stop by and wonder if the stickers were free. And unfortunately, some people were turned around when we said that we were fundraising with them. But luckily, when they found out what we were fundraising for, quite a few people were very generous. So from what I heard, we raised about $500 from the booth alone. And then after the booth, we decided to launch a GoFundMe for people who weren't able to visit the booth and do want to contribute more. We did set a goal to an estimate of $2,500, and we're just above $100 there right now.
Well, awesome. If people wanted to contribute to that GoFundMe, where could they do so?
So the GoFundMe link is in the bio of both the @BayAreaSRA Twitters and Instagrams. And I guess if you can type out the link right now, it would be gofundme.com/f/filtration-mask-fund.
Awesome. So based on your experience running this booth at Pride this year, is there anything that you feel like that you could have improved on that you would like to do better maybe next year? Where do you think you really succeeded, and what are areas that you think that you could do a little bit more work?
I feel like we had our booth peopled very well, but we could have definitely benefited from having a few more members to interact with the public. There were times when crowds of people would show up to our booth wanting to ask questions, but the several people that were already there were occupied and engaging with people on multiple fronts. And so that would maybe be a benefit next year. Also, getting past, you know, toxic people that were coming up to our booth wanting to argue and debate things, maybe having a better plan and getting through those kinds of people faster and getting the people that really want to learn more about us sooner would be better next year.
But I think we did a really good job of, so far, as staying on the same message when talking to people, you know, that we're not a militia, we're not a cult, things like that, that we're education first. So as far as ignoring all the negative reactions that we got, from what I witnessed other members talking to visitors, it went really well, I think.
Something that I had planned on doing that I didn't get to focus on was demonstrating to more folks how to use life-saving tools like tourniquets. I forgot my training tourniquets at home, and I was very hesitant to use my everyday carry tourniquets for demonstration purposes. But I did bring my props, and that was fun. If we can maybe incorporate that a little bit more next year and get people to be more interactive in the learning process and the knowledge that we can offer, that might be more beneficial.
Yeah, I think including something like that also was beneficial to our booth, instead of just focusing on, I guess, getting bare bones information out about the organization. Rob had his little demonstration going on that was drawing. I had the idea of having these large signs with the armed equality flags that people can take pictures of. I figured that people would pick them up and use it like a photo booth prop, but when some of us were carrying them to kind of draw people in, they wanted to take pictures with us instead. So some of us ended up kind of being like mascots, but like that beyond just talking about what the SRA is and more like a fun, because Pride is a celebration. Obviously it was a riot, but the way that Pride is handled in San Francisco, it's kind of just this really big party. So we also had to kind of fit in into that environment in order to draw people in and their attention.
Well, that's awesome. I think y'all did a really good job.
I just wanted to say one more thing. I really felt that it was an honor and a privilege that our first Pride organizing was the 50th anniversary of the first Pride.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like we were on the same message of Marsha P. Johnson's self-defense and protecting our communities. And it really felt like we were doing our best to carry out that message. So for everybody that came and visited the booth, interacted with us, we want to say thank you.
Well, that's awesome. I think y'all did a really good job. So is there anything else, like in addition to range days and, you know, similar activities, is there anything else your chapter does that you want to talk about, or anything that you're really proud of that you think you guys are doing a really good job on?
Yeah, I'm really pleased with our firearm-specific workshops that we've been incorporating. We use them to supplement our monthly range days, especially when we have multiple incoming new members that we want to get up to speed. And it also helps with what our one of our main goals is building community, just getting to know one another. So our firearm-specific workshops are a lot of fun because we meet in an off-range location. We get a chance to go over all the safety fundamentals and then demonstrate to our members how to safely manipulate whichever firearm we're working on, whether it be handgun specific or rifle specific. And then we get to do the fun stuff, which is get hands-on. Every member gets a chance to practice those disciplines. And then we also get to disassemble and reassemble. That's a lot of fun. When people aren't having to deal with bangs and buzzers going off from ceasefires at the range and people yelling, which is very stressful, when people don't have to deal with that, they can focus more on how things work and kind of eliminating the mystery and the scary things that people associate with firearms education. It's more comfortable. There's no judgment. There's nobody pretending to be a be-all, end-all gun expert, which is something that we encounter at ranges all the time, even myself, encountering cis white men who come up to me and say, like, oh, you know, that's not a man's caliber. Like, that's really tough. We need that kind of, that kind of sentiment or any of those statements ever made. And it's been really good. We've brought in guests to take a peek at what we can offer, and they're always really impressed.
Yeah, that's all true. We provide a lot of snacks too. So it's a very fun and inclusive, safe party that we got going on. And most importantly, educational. Because I did bring my partner to the last rifle workshop that we had, and he was quite surprised with how much knowledge he gained from those few hours we had together. And we are incredibly fortunate that we have so many members that are very knowledgeable about the firearms that they own, and the fact that all of us collectively own quite a few firearms for us to learn from.
Yeah, that's something I also just want to say. The members that attended weren't the only ones learning. I myself, even though I was giving the majority of the demonstration along with our other member, Curie, I gained some knowledge as well, and I was really pleased with that. So we're always learning. Even those of us who seem to have all the answers should still be learning. It's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And, you know, after seeing the success that you all had with events like that, the LA chapter has actually started doing that as well. I'm actually hosting one this Saturday for Los Angeles members.
That sounds so exciting. Let us know how it goes.
Absolutely. And I think that's definitely something that our chapters need to start doing in addition to range days, because like you said, trying to teach a new shooter basic handling of a firearm while you're on a range and there's people shooting, and there's range officers yelling. It can be really challenging. So doing that in a lower stress environment, I think, is a really good idea. And I think that's something that all of our chapters should work into their training programs.
Well, that's really, really good to hear.
All right. So before we finish off for the night, if you had one piece of advice to give to other SRA organizers, what would you say?
Well, for folks that are organizing with the SRA, many of us, it might be our first times. And a lot of us, even myself, worry about making mistakes because we definitely want to make our chapters the best that they can be for our members. But some, you know, no organizer started with all the knowledge base to be the most effective organizer. They all have to start from somewhere. They all have to learn somehow. Take chances, be mindful of your members, and don't worry so much about turning away people who, as I've said before, are toxic. Sometimes I hear things about people worried about turning away a member, not just turning away, but making people who have frail male egos feel unwelcomed or unwanted or targeted when we call out toxic behaviors. We can't really be too worried about those people not wanting to be a part of our organization. There are plenty of marginalized people in our communities that could benefit from the knowledge that we have to provide so much more. As many of us have experienced, gun culture in this country is very dominated by white supremacy and toxic masculinity. And it's easy to get into gun culture if you're male. And for the rest of us, we need to see people who look like us. We need to be around people who have shared the same experiences and have each, and we feel comfortable, confident that they have each other's backs, we have each other's backs. Currently, in a lot of gun environments that you go to at the range, you don't always feel that. And I'm sorry if I'm rambling.
No, definitely, I understand. And, you know, obviously we don't want to drive white men away, but there is a certain type of person who very much wants it to be about them. And we have to be careful to make sure that we are focusing on the people who need this sort of training and need this sort of exposure to guns the most, rather than people who could realistically get it elsewhere.
Exactly. And I know I'm going to kind of butcher this saying, but my partner uses the lifeguard at the swimming pool analogy about how there's somebody running around a pool, the lifeguard blows their whistle and says, "No running." When that happens, you don't go up to the lifeguard, ask the person who wasn't running, and say, "Hey, I wasn't running." Obviously, you weren't running. So you shouldn't really feel targeted by those kinds of comments. She could say it better than I could. I hope that makes sense.
No, I think I understand you. How about you, Mango?
Yeah, as far as my experience goes, two of the most important qualities of being an organizer on the left are empathy, patience, respect. In any sort of community organizing, when you're working for the people, we have to always remember that we are acting out of an intense amount of love for ourselves and our loved ones and our communities. So that is why, at least why I joined the SRA, because when I met up with Rob as a new member, I already felt included in something as very outside of how I grew up as a gun club, because I don't quite fit the demographic that is normally in this sort of environment. But thanks to our great organizer, I felt very included, and I can only hope that the rest of our members feel. Oh, can I plug something real quick? There was a direct action during the march that actually halted the parade for about an hour, I think, just to remind everybody what the origins of Pride were, especially with the fact that it was the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. And also, kind of ironically, unironically, the police got quite direct and resorted to some violence to some of those protesters. And if I could send you a link to one of the GoFundMes to help support one of the protesters or some of the protesters who were arrested, would you be able to put those in the show notes?
Absolutely. I can put that right there in the show notes. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for coming on. It's really nice hearing from your hands-on experience with this sort of thing, and I definitely think that's valuable experience and knowledge to share with the rest of the community.
Of course, we appreciate you.
All right, well, you two have a good one. Solidarity forever.
Love and solidarity.